this afternoon. 96-2361 W State X Rel Thomas Ryman versus the Circuit Court for Dane County. Mr. McDermott, you represent the state, I assume.
I am, Your Honor. James McDermott, Assistant Attorney General, appearing here for the respondent court and the respondent circuit judge, Judge Michael Torpy. We've got, Your Honors, I would submit one issue in this case, and it is simply this. In a situation where you have a person who has complained to a circuit judge pursuant to Section 968.26, the so-called John Doe statute, that such person has reason to believe that a crime has been committed within that circuit judge's jurisdiction, does that section or a particular piece of language therein, which I'll discuss this afternoon, does that section require such judge to examine the complainant under oath and any witnesses produced by him or her? Now, we have only one argument to make, and that argument, Your Honors, is that to avoid a construction of Section 968.26, the John Doe statute, which would produce an absurd result, we submit that it should be construed to permit a judge, in the exercise of his or her discretion, to examine or not to examine the complainant under oath and any witnesses produced by him or her. The exact language of the statute, Your Honor, I'm talking about is the part of 968.26 reading, I quote, if a person complains to a judge that he or she has reason to believe that a crime has been committed within his or her jurisdiction, the judge shall examine the complainant under oath and any witnesses produced by him or her. Now, it's clear that the decision under review herein, may it please the court, took the position that that language, that shall within that particular language, is mandatory rather than permissive. Now, we submit that to construe shall in that context produces manifestly absurd results. And as this court has recognized, and I'm quoting, the fundamental axiom of judicial construction is that it avoid any result that would be absurd or unreasonable under the facts and circumstances of the case.
But what's absurd?
Pardon?
What is absurd about reading it as
mandatory? Two things. You've got to assume here that when complaints are filed of this nature, John Doe, when somebody comes into the judge and submits, and we'll presume it's going to be a written complaint, those complaints are going to be filed sometimes by persons, and more often than not by persons who are appearing pro se. And they may be persons who are incarcerated, and then again, they may not be. Of those persons who are incarcerated and who would submit that type of complaint, I think it can be fairly and reasonably assumed that some of them may be in a vengeful frame of mind and desirous of revenge or reprisal against the law enforcement people who put them behind bars. I think that's a fair assumption. It can also be assumed, I think, that whether these persons be free or incarcerated, they're going to, at times, file complaints that are patently meritless. They may be, and I'm going to compare them later to what you see in the area of pro se complaints and civil litigation, they may be complaints that are unintelligible. They may be complaints that are obviously prepared by people who are literally seething with vengeance and who may say a lot of harsh and pejorative things in the complaint about various and sundry people. But there aren't any, there's no undergirding of facts presented in the complaint. There's no showing or indication that if you examine that complaint or the persons that he produces witnesses, that they would come up with anything convincing by way of facts indicating criminal activity.
Well, then I guess you're asking us to read some words into the statute. You want to say, the judge shall examine the complainant under oath and any witness produced by him or her.
That's right.
If the paper record shows probable cause or credible evidence or is not patently ridiculous. That's what you want to say.
I think that's true. I mean, if the judge looks at that complaint, and I think if the person comes and it's not writing, he can require. I think the court can, and I think indeed the court should, in its own interest, require the complaint to be in writing. And I think if the judge then looks at that complaint and concludes that, well, yes, perhaps there is a reasonable basis for this, and I should indeed call these people, and I better examine them, and I will examine the complainant and any witnesses he or she may produce, yes, then go forward. Otherwise, I say that the judge should have a discretion, and that in the exercise of that discretion, if he's looking at something that's unintelligible, that's perhaps prepared by somebody suffering from dementia, and that's possible, and any one of those things that produce something that's obviously a non-meritorious or a frivolous complaint, under those circumstances, the court should be free to exercise its discretion and not take one further step.
If they Mr. Think- McDermott, let me ask you, would the only restriction on the judge be the erroneous exercise of discretion? Would you put any type of framework around this exercise of discretion?
Well, I think you'd have a situation analogous to that which you have, and I know you judges are from justices are familiar with this, 814.29.1a. Frequently we have people going into circuit courts and they want to commence an action in formal paupers. And it's up to the court, it's a decision of the court, incidentally, not the judge under those circumstances, to decide whether or not that person can so proceed. And if he decides, for example, that the proposed complaint that he's looking at isn't arguably meritorious, he can turn thumbs down on that. But what our courts have said then, and what has been made very clear, is that if he or she does so, the judge does so, then the person who has been seeking that leave can go into an appellate court, into the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, and seek a writ of mandamus. The writ being sought on the theory, of course, that the judge has had a plain duty under the circumstances to permit the individual to proceed IFP, and he's not complying with that plain duty. Now, you'd have a comparable situation here. If a complaint were submitted to a judge, a John Doe complaint, and it clearly would arguably indicate that he should proceed to examine the complainant and any of his or her witnesses, then, as I've indicated, I'm not arguing that John Doe judges are free without any appellate review to take the position that they're not going to go any further, that they're not going to examine the complainant and his witnesses or her witnesses under oath. Not free to do so indeed, because there would be a review and a check against any unhealthy procedure that might occur by a John Doe judge who for whatever the reason, and without good reason, let's say, declined to proceed to examine the complainant and his or her witnesses.
That appeal is to the Court of Appeals?
That would be to the Court of Appeals. That's correct. And, Your Honor, there is case law. I haven't cited that case law in my brief, but I would call it to the attention of the Court now. I have said that there is this remedy available, and there is case law in Wisconsin that shows that you can go for a writ of mandamus, apply for a writ of mandamus, as against a judge only, not against both court and judge, or only against the court, but against the judge only, on the theory that he has a plain duty as a public officer to do something. And that case law is to be found in State versus Washington, 83 West 2nd, 808, and there's State X Rel Nijiko, I guess it is, v. Coffey, that's 22 West 2nd, 392, and there is also, there is case law, State X Rel Terry v. Traeger, 60 West 2nd, 490, Your Honors, that indicates that you can sue a judge in a supervisory writ proceeding, and that was mandamus, and the only respondent in that case was Judge Traeger. So what I'm saying, I won't dwell further on that point. I want to, if I may, get to the second kind of absurdity that a judge would be burdened on with, rather, should this court decide that the shall in question is mandatory. And that's this. You have a situation in this state where a district attorney who is a quasi-judicial officer, his is a high post indeed, but he's quasi-judicial, he's not judicial. He has an extremely broad, wide discretion, as this court well knows, to charge an offense, and that extends to even an initial investigation. And I cited case law in my brief, so show. That's true of the district attorney. However, you've got a situation here where if you give a mandatory construction to the shall in question, you have a judge, a full-fledged judicial officer, who doesn't enjoy that kind of discretion. He's going to have to start his investigation under the John Doe willy-nilly, no matter how unintelligible or extreme or nonsensical the complaint might be that was filed with him. That conjures up very easily I'll give you a hypothetical situation. Man walks into the district attorney's office, sits down, tells a plausible story about how a crime is being committed in the county, and he wants the judge to do or the DA to do something about it. But as he's leaving, he tells the district attorney, you know, the reason I know all these things is because I'm Jehovah, and I'm omniscient, and I know all these things. I've encountered Jehovah in my work in pro se cases, a fellow out in central Wisconsin. Well, I'm sure when the door was closed, the district attorney would sanely and sensibly conclude, I'm not going to move an inch on this. I'm not going to use any of my finite resources to investigate this thing. That same chap, however, could a couple of days later present himself in the judge's office, hand the judge a complaint, which incidentally would include a representation that it's closed, that he was Jehovah, and that all the facts that he presented therein, which might sound fairly plausible, but that he knew them because of his omniscience as God Almighty. If you construe shall as mandatory in this particular statute, the judge is going to have to proceed to examine that gentleman and any witnesses called by him. Everyone. Now, I want to make one more comment on this particular argument. Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
What do you read, how do you read the sentence, the following sentence, after the one you've all been arguing about? The extent to which the judge may proceed in the examination is within the judge's discretion.
Yes. Your Honor, I've addressed that in the brief.
No, but I want you to address it now.
And I'm perfectly happy to address it once again. I don't think that particular statute has any bearing on whether or not the shall we're talking about is mandatory or permissive.
I would hang right on to that.
Pardon? Why do I think that?
Yeah.
Well,
I think they may proceed in the examination. That means they may never have even started.
Judge Abrahams and Justice, I've got a confession to make. Bill Clinton and I share something in common. We share a birthday, and my hearing is going.
Okay.
Now, could you ask?
You're 52.
Not by a darn sight.
You heard that. All right. I say to you, why can't you read? I mean, you have trouble reading shall is may. Just the next line of 968-26 says, or other witnesses produced by him or her, and may. Judge may do that, but if the DA requests it, the judge has to do it. So, I mean, may and shall is all over this statute, and it's used the way we ordinarily use it, mandatory and permissive. So you're either going to try and get us to say shall is may, or you're going to ask us to put in several more lines, read several lines into this. Why don't you just hang your hat on the extent to which the judge may proceed in the examination is within the judge's discretion.
Well, I haven't hung my hat on that peg, and maybe I was imprudent not to do so, but...
Well,
it bothered me.
Pardon? I said that sentence bothered me.
Well, then I may, concededly, I may be in error in arguing that it has no bearing on Michelle, but I
take whatever peg works.
Right. Whatever it takes, right?
Pardon?
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. That's right, Justice Bedwin. Now,
so you accept, I assume, the friendly amendment here, or at least the suggestion that if we would read that second sentence as giving the judge the discretion that you're requesting, that he could temper his acceptance, the shall, by using his or her discretion.
Yes, if you want to give that sentence that construction, certainly it would independently support the argument I'm making here. It would do so. I didn't make that argument, and I guess I'll cease on that point at this point. I do want to stress that an important feature of the brief that's been submitted here by Mr. Ryman is that it does not address at all our argument as to this second absurdity that would be produced by a mandatory interpretation of the word shall in the statute in question. There's an absolute silence on that particular argument, and I view that silence, I think I view it rightly, as a concession of the correctness and the soundness of our argument as to that absurd result.
Is that the absurd result about the DA?
That's right. That's right. That's correct. No. And I've been arguing cases in this court for 39 years, Your Honors, and I think this occasion is a rather happy one. I don't recall that I've ever been able to argue that in any case opposing counsel has made a major concession of this type, and it warms the cockles of my heart. I really don't think that I need take... Well, I have a little time left. The yellow light hasn't gone on yet.
But you don't have to.
Pardon?
Don't have to.
I just want to touch briefly on the Wisconsin cases and on a Michigan case that are dealt with in our brief. Two of those Wisconsin cases, one of them has the name Cannon in the title. The second is State v. John Doe. Both of those arguably lend some support, very feeble support, I would characterize it, lend some support to the position taken by Mr. Ryman in this case. But reading of those cases, the briefs involved and whatnot shows, they very clearly did not involve this particular issue. The court wasn't confronted with that issue and really didn't rule on it, I would submit. There is a third Wisconsin case that arguably provides some support, I would again say very feeble, to our side of the case, to our position. The language used, though, is obiter dictum, and again, that case did not address the issue presented here. The Michigan case, decided back, I checked this out in my history books last night, in the administration of Rutherford B. Hayes, a different world than the world we live in now, where there's been an explosion of litigation and where there are so much of what I would call abusive remedy, not abusive process, not the tort, but abusive remedy. Resort to remedy when there should be no resort, frivolous resort, inexcusably frivolous resort. But anyhow, that Michigan case dealt with a Michigan statute that has language very similar to our own. And the Michigan case, again, however, did not. It shared the same fundamental weakness that the Wisconsin cases, Cannon and State v. Dole, have. It really didn't address the issue here involved. So I have asked the court to view those cases as not being conclusive on the issue here before you this afternoon, and I would simply resubmit that request that they not be so considered. I don't think I need argue further on this matter. I would urge a reversal of the decision of the Court of Appeals, which is under review here, and I think that reversal would preclude the imposition on judges throughout Wisconsin of absurd burdens. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. McDermott. Mr. DeWin? here with the Frank Remington Center representing Mr. Reinen. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Pete DeWind. I'm not 52 either.
How's your hearing? How's your hearing?
What?
Until this afternoon, I've considered it to be good, but I might change my mind if I can't answer a question. I represent Tom Reinen in this case, and the John Doe petitioner. Sitting next to me at council table is Jamie Robinson, who's a law student at the Frank J. Remington Center, who's been assisting me in preparation for this argument. I ask this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, which remanded the case to the trial judge to hold a John Doe hearing. I believe the statute is unambiguous in requiring a hearing. Shall means shall. There are exceptions, but the only time exceptions come into play is when there's some other legislative intent that's indicated somewhere that indicates the reading shouldn't be mandatory. That's what the cases that find that shall does not mean shall have to do with.
I was just going to ask what meaning, and the question was asked of opposing counsel, that the second sentence, as far as the extent to which the judge may proceed, is within the judge's discretion. Wouldn't that seem to give discretion for the judge to apply to the first sentence in 968.26?
To me, that second sentence governs how long the examination will go, but it doesn't do anything to change the meaning of the first sentence, that some examination has to take place. Now,
why can't it just be an examination of an affidavit, a statement under oath?
In other words, an examination just of the writing? The state didn't argue that, but I think that it is a good point. I think the other parts of the statute, though, the wording of those other parts of the statute imply definitively that a hearing is required. One being that second sentence, the extent of the examination. To me, that means there's going to be some examination. How much, we don't know. The statute talks about whether counsel can't make any arguments at the examination, that counsel can't cross-examine. All that implies that there's a hearing taking place. Now, I can understand the concern about the state, about unintelligible, totally preposterous petitions, and then that would burden the courts. Now, several responses to that. First, I don't think there's any evidence that that is actually happening. There are some John Doe petitions. Most, to the best of my understanding, are filed by district attorney's offices as an aid to investigation. But I think some are filed by people, whether prisoners, anyone else.
Well, since this is a case of first impression, basically, if we were to side with your position, do you think that would make any difference as far as cases being filed?
I think that it could definitely lead to, jailhouse lawyers perhaps starting to file these things. And that is a concern. I think there is, although I agree with the result of the Court of Appeals, that this case should be remanded, I think that there is a threshold test that if this court choose to impose, it could impose, but that does not get to the point of, or does not affect the conclusion that shall means shall in the context of having a hearing. Let me explain. I know that sounds confusing even as I say it to myself. The first line of the John Doe statute is, if a person complains to a judge that he or she has reason to believe a crime has been committed, the judge shall examine, or then the judge shall examine. I think those words, reason to believe, could imply an objective test that a trial judge could impose to screen cases. Once that initial burden is met, which I think if it is imposed, would have to be a very low burden, even less than the probable cause that would result after the hearing, I think that it is a burden that judges can impose. And I think that by imposing such a burden, that the courts could avoid having to hear the kinds of petitions that that Mr. McDermott so rightly is concerned about.
Is your suggestion...
Just state the burden again. So how would you read the statute? Judge shall examine the complainant under oath.
The way I read the statute, the most reasonable interpretation I can find of it is that there is no threshold test. Yeah, I agree with the Court of Appeals. But in giving this court an opportunity to create a threshold test, I think that those words, reason to believe, could be found to be an objective test that the court could use to say to judges that they can screen some cases.
Does that mean we're screening, the judges are screening cases without an actual appearance based upon the affidavit under oath? Or does this mean you're requiring an appearance and then the judge can, in a cursory manner, complete it?
If the court wants to impose such an objective test, I believe they could do so without even requiring a hearing. The phrase comes before the shall examine.
You agree that if a person complains to a judge that he or she has reason to believe that a crime has been committed within his or her jurisdiction, upon reason to believe, or after reason, finding reason to believe on the basis of the written documents, the judge shall examine.
Right. Shall still means shall, but that screening device is there. Now, again, I don't believe, when I read the words of the statute, it still says to me, if a person in their subjective view believes they have reason to believe a crime has been committed, but I believe those words, reason to believe, are ambiguous. Not the shall examine under oath, which follows it, but those words, reason to believe. If this court finds that those words are ambiguous, it can, it can do the judicial construction.
Mr. DeWind, how then does your test differ from what Mr. McDermott requested of the court?
Well,
I mean, I read in his words, too, but in essence, they were saying, look at the written documents, and if they're good enough, then you have to have a hearing. If they're not good enough, you'd kind of dump it. It sounds to me like you and the, other than your position, which I understand, your first step is we don't read anything in. If you don't win on that, this is your compromise position, right?
That's correct.
Well, how is it different than Mr. McDermott?
I don't think it is very different, and I think that that's... I think it's a stretch to impose such an objective test, but I think it's one that still maintains the integrity of shall means shall once whatever that burden is determined to be is met. Now, I agree with you that it appears to be like the state's idea about what's preposterous, but I think it has to be a very, very low standard. And for me, as Mr. Ryman's lawyer, I'm most concerned that he gets his hearing. And I don't think his case is the kind that is the sort that Mr. McDermott is claiming are, would be burdening the courts. And I don't think that, and I myself don't think it is either. I think Mr. Ryman's petition has some merit. It's not in the briefs, facts aren't there. But it is in the correspondence file which the court has on this case, there being no formal record in this case, that in the John Doe petition, there are several allegations of criminal conduct, and I think Judge Torfey may have been doing ultimately what I would say could be a test that this court could impose, looking at the paperwork, but I think he was wrong about the decision, in wrong in finding that there was nothing in Mr. Ryman's petition that could conceivably be a crime.
That's the test that was suggested by opposing counsel. In other words, the judge looks at it, he turns it down, goes up to the appellate court, and they would then examine it to see if they would grant the supervisory writ to send it back down.
If that test is adopted. Again, I think the primary place, I think what the state should really be doing in this case is going to the legislature and having the statute changed. For the last 5 years, the Criminal Procedure Committee of the Judicial Council has been working on an extensive rewrite of all the criminal procedure statutes. One important change in their view is, and there's been many drafts, but the most recent within the last couple of weeks, clearly puts discretion in as far as whether the hearing has to take place. I think that's a legislative decision to make.
What standard does the draft use? What standard does the draft use for the judge to determine whether or not to have an examination?
Right. In the most recent draft, which I think was adopted on September 18th, this is public record, a person may file a petition with the judge requesting that the judge determine whether a crime has been committed and by whom. That's sub one, basically. Sub 2A, if the facts alleged, if true, would not constitute probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, the judge may dismiss the petition. Need not, but may. Sub 2, sub B, if the facts alleged, if true, would constitute probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, the judge may refer the petition to the district attorney to determine whether a prosecution should be commenced. or direct the district attorney to report to the court the reasons underlying the district attorney's failure to or refusal to issue a complaint in the matter. And on that point, I think it's an important one that there are, I think, strong policy reasons to require a district attorney to look at a case first. There are two statutes that are fairly similar, the John Doe statute and 968.02 sub 3, which allows a judge to issue a criminal complaint if the district attorney refuses or is unavailable. And both of those sections, under this most recent draft by the Criminal Procedure Committee of the Judicial Council, would coordinate those two into this one statute, eliminating the previous two.
Mr. DeWin, let me ask you this. If, under your compromise position, a complainant were merely to say that what the statute says, that he or she has reason to believe that a crime has been committed without giving any real detail, is that sufficient?
The categories of cases that I think would be appropriate to dismiss using the standard, not that I suggest necessarily, but that I think is reasonable given possible ambiguity in the words reason to believe, are fairly along the lines of what Mr. McDermott is trying to weed out. And again, I'm representing Mr. Ryman. I want him to have a hearing. I think the facts of his petition warrant a hearing. But the kinds of complaints that could be weeded out are unintelligible or gibberish complaints. Maybe they say 968.26 at the top and list the name of the district attorney, and then it's gibberish. I don't think a hearing would be required then under that reading of reason to believe. Impossibilities. Now, President Clinton has been sending me radio waves into my brain, and that's been causing injury, and I feel he's committed a crime by doing that. You know, impossibilities. If the statute of limitations...
Don't be too sure that those are...
I won't concede the point. If the statute of limitations has passed, in other words, if someone is complaining about a felony, not murder, from 40 years ago, even if it may have been a crime, the judge wouldn't have to hold a hearing in that kind of case. And also the facts that, that even if true, wouldn't constitute a crime. In other words, you know, someone looked at me funny and I was injured by that, and so that person committed some kind of crime on me by looking at me funny. I think that those are the kind of cases, I think it's, although those would cover a lot of the cases that I think the state's most concerned about, I think they would still, allow the court to weed out the worst ones.
Would you have us write those kind of exceptions into a decision? How would you suggest that we set forth a decision?
I would suggest saying that the words of the statute are plain and clear. The legislature can at any time, and has at any time in the last 160 years, been able to change that language. As recently as 1991, they changed one of the words shall in the statute to a may, but not this one. They could have done so, and that the place to go is the legislature. There's proceedings in the, or there's statutory ability of, you know, the people at the legislature watch decisions out of this court, obviously, and upon giving a direction to look at a statute, they do so. But if this other alternative is followed, the reason to believe being ambiguous, going that route.
Okay, can you tell us what that route is again? Are you saying that if the facts alleged, if true, would not constitute probable cause, then there's no duty? Is that what your test is? Or put the other way, if the facts alleged, if true, would constitute probable cause, then there is a duty to hold a hearing. Is that what your second alternative is? I'm just trying to get the test that you're putting.
Right. I'm not sure on that point.
Give me the
two. I'd say that the facts, even if true, could not possibly constitute a crime. You know, I want it to be a very low threshold to get rid of the most frivolous and absurd petitions.
The probable cause one you read was from the Judicial Council or minutes.
Right, I believe that's in there.
But that's not the one you want. I get it. Because you want something less than that.
Yeah, about 10 minutes ago you gave Justice and the Chief some answer.
You set a threshold test upon finding reason to believe from the written documents. Reason to believe what?
That
a crime is committed.
Right. The
probable cause.
I think if anything, it has to be less than probable cause.
Reasonable suspicion?
I'm not familiar as enough as I should be with the words that could express it, but I think that because the reason for the hearing in the John Doe statute is to determine whether there is probable cause, that if there is this threshold test, it has to be even less than that. Probable cause itself is a very, very low standard, and I think that to kick cases that are so weak that they shouldn't even have a hearing, it shouldn't even be up to a level of probable cause. Otherwise, why have the hearing that you could just decide on the basis of the paperwork to issue a complaint? And I don't think anybody would want that.
Well, you have a probable cause hearing you have a probable cause standard for a complaint, and you also have a probable cause standard for a preliminary examination. So obviously the criminal law believes that there's something different about a hearing than there is about words on paper.
That's correct, and for whatever reason, the decision to charge is obviously an incredibly important one. Legislature has seen fit to impose or to maintain two checks on that power, that being the John Doe statute and the 968.02 sub 3 that I talked about, that under current revisions that are possibly in place, would eliminate those and put those into one. But it's an important check. And that sort of gets to the point, too, that the state was raising about failing to address the argument about the judge having not having the discretion whether to proceed or not, and the district attorney having that discretion. I think that it's vital in order to have a check to have the judge have to look a little bit closer at this kind of thing than the district attorney's office.
But here you're also suggesting, assuming that you're now saying the judge does have and should have discretion to weed out these very obvious ones that would fall beneath the standards you're suggesting. Also, you suggest in your brief that you could use a teleconference or phone as they do in the preliminary examination. I assume that you would also suggest that could be done, that the court should set some standards as to how the phone conversation or the teleconferencing should be handled in our decision.
That's correct. And again, I want to keep emphasizing that my view is that this statute is unambiguous, that it requires a hearing. I realize that I don't think that one can even look to absurd results, under my reading of the law, unless there's an ambiguity. I don't think there's ambiguity in shall examine. But again, on your point with the telephone hearings, I think that that would be good, even if the court adopted that primary position I have, to put such language in to make it clear that phone hearings can occur. Now, I think I explained in a way that...
Actually, Mr. DeWine, isn't our primary purpose to give intent to what the legislature intended, to determine what the legislature... When all is said and done, our job is to determine what it is the legislature intended.
That's correct.
Certainly the legislature didn't intend... Would you agree that the legislature did not intend to give a person who files a complaint with the judge... And the complaint says that he's being attacked by aliens from Galaxy 264. Are you saying that under the law that the legislature intended that kind of petition should be given an examination under oath?
Well,
in person?
I would have to say that I guess not. The statute goes back to 1839 when Wisconsin was a statute. The language at issue here is very little changed from that. Frankly, I don't think that they were thinking of that sort of thing at the time.
No,
but they
might have had another absurdity, like, maybe there's a Northwest Passage or something.
Perhaps. But I think they could have easily just put in the word may from the beginning, or at any point in those 160 years, that word shall could have been changed to a may and not had to be a problem. But I think that by the legislature not having changed that, it evinces an intent that whether a crime has occurred is an important enough thing that they'd rather err on the side of having a hearing than not having a hearing, even possibly with preposterous complaints.
Let me ask you about another type of proceeding, and you may not be able to answer this, but I was trying to think of some other kind of proceeding where this may occur, and the only one that I could think of and could find, and it's not completely analogous, is a writ of habeas corpus. The statute on the writ of habeas corpus, of course, lays out in detail what the petition has to say, but that's just basically a person who is illegally detained. There's some basic allegations that have to be made. 78206 indicates that the court or judge to which such petition shall be properly presented shall grant the same without delay unless it shall appear from the petition or from the documents annexed that the party applying therefore is prohibited from prosecuting the same. And although I don't know what the last part of that sentence refers to, I suspect there's a 78202 talks about who's not entitled to writs of habeas corpus, and there's certain people that aren't. But assuming that somebody who at least allegedly is entitled to it, submits a document that comports, at least in allegation form, with 78204, but also may have gobbledygook in it, the question, I guess, is whether or not a judge must absolutely grant the writ and go ahead to a hearing. And all I know that there's at least one case that deals with a judge who didn't sign one and whether he had to pay the penalties or not. But it seems to me in practice that there is some screening that goes on by judges on writs by looking at the writ and seeing whether there's enough here to bring a prisoner down. And I don't know whether that's based on law or whether it's practice. Have you looked at that area at all to see whether it relates to what we're talking about?
I haven't, and so I'm not aware of case law that might be in place interpreting that.
Because it's mandatory language, too, it seems to me, that if it's properly presented and it doesn't come from somebody who's prohibited from filing it, it appears that it's a mandatory. And again, you have the same problem of having to bring somebody who's in custody to the courtroom to have a hearing.
Assuming that there is no case law interpreting that statute, so that the situation would be similar to the one here where no one's court of appeals, the state, we haven't been able to find any authority on this point about shall examine what that means. I would say that yes, given if the statute on its face seems to indicate that the writ will be granted, in other words, not to release the person, but to get the person into court, I would think would be what would be needed there, which is fairly analogous to this case, to at least present their case, that the plain language rule should govern, that that's the paramount axiom of judicial construction, and that if anyone disagrees with that or if it's being abused, that then the statute can and probably will be changed by the legislature. I think the fact that the legislature hasn't changed it indicates that this isn't the nightmarish kind of problems with this that the state appears to think it is.
I'm going to ask you about that statute, too, so if you give that some thought in terms of the writ of habeas corpus.
I think it's a different case if it's a preposterous complaint, because Mr. Ryman's isn't.
Well, I, too, have been trying to think of the multitude of procedures, and I thought about the Mockner, which was ineffective assistance of counsel. And, you know, that's a constitutional allegation, and yet you don't have to give the person a hearing unless their papers come up to, and I'm using snuff because I don't remember what the standard is. So it just strikes me that there are just a multitude of things like this that look mandatory, but they're really not, because you have to get to a threshold. What that threshold is, I'm not sure.
Again, I think that I haven't looked at those other areas of the law, but I think that the decision on what the courts have held and when they have put some discretion in, it has to be based on the specific words of that statute that's at issue. And looking at the words of this statute in the absence of case law, I think the words are clear.
You're not taken with my second sentence either, are you? The extent to which the judge may proceed. You think you've got that deals with first the examination and then how much you go afterwards?
I think so. And I wasn't sure exactly what you were referring to, but you, my understanding of what you were saying was that the court, the extent could be nothing.
Right.
To me, that's not, to me, it works in favor of a mandatory hearing, because extent to me implies at least the beginning of it, especially in light of the other words of the statute, which say shall examine under oath, and counsel being not able to argue or cross-examine, all those imply the hearing taking place, in my view.
Mr. DeWin, if you have more, you may proceed. If not, you need not.
emphasize that last point. I think that it's important to look to all parts of the statute to determine what the meaning is. And as far as the state's discussion of dicta in the cases that seemed, in his view, to support my position, the Cannon case and the Doe case, the Court of Appeals acknowledged that that it was a case of first impression, that the decision in Cannon, which is the only case it cited, implied a result that there must be a hearing. And in response to the state's extensive arguments in its brief about dicta not being that we shouldn't even look at it because it's dicta, I think that's exactly what dicta is for, is to for other cases to look at. Not that it's a mandatory authority, but something to look at to help gauge their decision. And I think those cases do help support my view that a hearing is required. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
DeWin. Before you sit
Sorry.
Down, let me ask you a question or two about the petition for the John Doe proceedings itself. You had indicated that that petition, in your opinion, would meet your compromise standard. Is that indeed your position in regard to both the special agent for the Department of Justice and the assistant district attorney?
I'll give a quick summary of what I think to be the portions of that John Patel petition that I think are enough to get him a hearing, even under this compromise standard. First, at Mr. Ryman's jury trial, the special agent testified, and again, the special agent testified that no promises were made to the confidential informant, the only confidential informant involved in this case, that the state never promised any chances of him getting out of his pending charge. But on appeal, or through open records request, through a civil suit that Mr. Ryman filed against the special agent, and also through his appellate attorneys, he was able to start getting investigative reports, copies of a written agreement, though the copy he has is unsigned, we don't know whether a copy was ever signed, that indicate promises to that confidential informant. I think that that's at least a reason to believe that the agent committed perjury in saying there are no promises. That would be what a hearing would help determine. Second, I believe that the special agent did testify at an evidentiary hearing that his administrator, and not himself, was the one responsible for forwarding investigative reports to the district attorney's office. About 9 months later, in responses to interrogatories in the civil case, he answered a question under oath that he was the one responsible for providing the investigative reports. Now, all Mr. Ryman knows is that he didn't get the investigative reports before trial. He had to use several different tactics to just try to obtain these, and did obtain various reports afterward. And those show inconsistent statements that, to me, violate the false swearing statute 946.32 sub 1 sub b, which is two inconsistent statements by a public official. And third, as to either the district attorney or the special agent, possibly a misconduct in public office charge for failure to perform a ministerial duty because someone didn't forward the reports to Mr. Ryman. It was either the district attorney or it was a special agent. Maybe it wasn't the special agent's job to forward the reports. Maybe it was his administrator. The testimony differs. As Mr. Ryman keeps getting this additional information after the fact, it builds more and more of a case that someone didn't provide him with stuff that they were required to provide him with and which were specifically requested in discovery. And I think that the as far as this, the whole statute of limitations issue, which hasn't come up, Mr. Ryman filed this case 4 months before the 6-year statute of limitations in felonies. But it wasn't like he was sitting on his hands for the whole 6 years. He had filed all these open records requests, done his post-conviction work in his criminal case, filed a civil suit. He wrote to the district attorney, he wrote to the attorney general's office with the complaints he's raising here. None of that worked. He filed it still within statute of limitations, but that's, you know, could explain why he, that explains why he filed it, you know, so close to the end of what could be a deadline, although some of these things that I've been referring to would have a later deadline, later statute of limitations, that inconsistent statements. One was made in April of 92, the other in January of 93. It goes back to the first statement, which would be the April of 92, which puts him well within the statute of limitations on that point. I think that the court, I see my time is up.
You may finish your sentence.
I think that the court has to, even though a lot of these allegations might not have merit, I think some do, and if even one does, I think this court should either affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals or remand with directions that this complaint sets forth enough to get Mr. Ryman, my client, a hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeWin.
That would be on the basis of an abuse of discretion, not by the trial judge, if we do the latter.
I would wouldn't concede that. I could because the complaint is in writing. I think that it could be a de novo review because the court reviewing it could just as easily look to the actual words and to see whether they felt that there was reason to believe. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeWind.
You are to be complimented for bringing the first issue of this nature on an 1839 statute.
if I may, Your Honors, first of all, I'm going to have to ask the court to please ignore any of Mr. DeWin's argument on the matter of whether or not Mr. Ryman's complaint made down in the circuit court has any merit. And let me say why I make that request, and I think justifiably so, because at page 16 of Mr. Ryman's brief, there appears the significant statement, the merits of his complaint are not at issue here. I'm blindsided if I have to. I didn't come here, understandably, I didn't come here prepared to submit any argument as to whether or not Mr. Ryman's complaint had merit or not. And I didn't, because counsel clearly indicated in the brief that he filed in this case, and rightly indicated that that's not an issue in this case. I would really request the court to ignore his argument. I'm not criticizing him.
Well, of course, Mr. McDonald, you know, it's not an issue if you prevail or if he prevails,
yeah.
But if we prevail, that's some middle ground, then it might well become an issue. Neither you nor Mr. DeWine are subject to criticism for that.
Again, I'd simply say that I didn't come here prepared and understandably.
Sure.
I didn't argue the issue.
We'll make the argument for you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Now, the further thing I would want to point out is that I think the screening test that Mr. DeWin talks about, and he talks about it in terms of being a compromise, and the part of the statute that we have in mind containing the shall language, I don't think they can live together. They can't be bedfellows. You can't have both of them there. I think, frankly, when Mr. DeWin calls his so-called screening test a compromise, he's using a euphemism. It is a surrender. He is admitting and conceding that you can proceed to ignore the business that he says is mandatory if you come to some kind of a conclusion that is compatible with his screening test. I just don't think there's any doubt about it. They can't live together.
Mr. McDermott?
Yes.
He argued in the alternative, his best bet, what he really wants is shall.
Yeah.
He seems to have some doubts whether he's going to get that whole loaf. And so, as counsel, he's arguing for a threshold test. Is his threshold test acceptable to you?
Well.
And if not, you give me a better one.
No, it's not acceptable to me.
Okay.
No.
Why not?
I might even say to the court this. There was some discussion in our office when I was working on the brief on this. I talked with some other colleagues of mine, experienced people. There was some discussion of this particular language. And there was one of our people who thought that, I think he thought in terms of the screening test that Mr. DeWind is talking about. Frankly, I wasn't grabbed by the idea then. I continue to be unentranced by it, and I'm not going to make the argument here.
Well, so then tell me how the judge should exercise his or her discretion.
Pardon?
How should the judge exercise his or her discretion?
Again, I think I've indicated that the judge should take a good, careful look, give a careful reading to anything that's submitted by way of a John Doe complaint, careful and conscientious reading, and if the judge concludes that it's unintelligible, if the judge concludes that the facts it purports to state or recites are not facts which constitute the commission of a crime, if you have that type of thing, if the judge concludes that the author of the complaint is obviously and unfortunately demented, and that the complaint is a product of madness, under any of those things and governed by those considerations, the judge then should exercise his discretion to refuse to commence the examination of the complainant and his or her witnesses.
Could you state that rule positively? When is the judge, under your theory, required to call the plaintiff and the witness?
Well, I guess I'd like to be able to sit down and write something on this, but just firing from the hip, I would say positively the judge is required to proceed to examine the complainant and any witnesses he or she may produce. If the complaint presents substantial and convincing reasons why a John Doe proceeding should be initiated. That's about as close as I can come to it.
That's
speaking.
More than probable cause.
Pardon?
Higher than probable cause.
Well, yeah, you could maybe work that probable cause language into the fabric of that declaration.
Okay.
Mr. McDermott, did you give any thought to whether or not there's any analogy to be drawn between a writ of habeas corpus and the command of the statute that the judge shall issue a writ and this statute?
Well, I do think there's a difference. When you're dealing with the writ of habeas corpus, and we're talking about the writ of habeas corpus ad subiectiendum, love that, and the great writ. When we're talking about the great writ, we're talking of something of tremendously vital importance, as this court well knows, and as everybody, I'm sure, in this courtroom knows this afternoon. That, of course, is the writ that produces a person in court so that he or she may speedily challenge the validity of his or her incarceration.
Okay, so my question to you is that if the petitioner, you think the shall in that statute means shall, that once the petition is submitted, the court can't decide by looking at it is whether it's gobbledygook or whether it has some merit, but that a judge shall issue it and command the sheriff to bring the defendant to the courtroom, regardless.
Well, I think you'd have a mandatory. Yeah, as I recall the statutes, and I haven't looked at the habeas corpus statutes recently, but it seems to me that I think the rule is, in fact, the judge can be can pay $1,000.
Right.
If the judge, but the, as I recall, the petition has to be, what is the language? It's got to be legal in
properly presented.
Yeah, well, and there's some other language, too.
Well, the language describes what the contents have to say that the person is being illegally detained.
I think then, of course, because we're dealing with the writ and the importance of it and the importance of getting a person into court so that he or she may challenge his or her incarceration, I think that's mandatory. But I don't think, frankly, I don't think that particular, the habeas corpus statutes, have any impact or bearing on the question before the court here this afternoon. One further thing I wanted to call, just this, no more.
Good, because your red light's on, so your red light is on.
All right.
Yes, you may.
All right. I'll finish the statement. I think there's a sentence here in the brief of my worthy opponent that I think says more about how weak Mr. Ryman's case is and how strong our case is than anything that I've said here this afternoon or anything I said in either one of the two briefs that we filed in this case. And that sentence appears at page 6 of Mr. Ryman's brief, and it reads, if a statute is unambiguous, courts are not to consider whether absurd or unreasonable results might occur, unquote. That shows Mr. Ryman and Mr. Ryman's counsel, I submit, taking the position, I think a completely unwarranted and unjustifiable position, that this court is in a straitjacket and that it is powerless to do anything to prevent a statute from imposing absurd and unreasonable burdens on our courts of law. I conclude with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McDermott. Thank you, Mr. DeWin. The court's in recess until 9:45 tomorrow.
Thank you.